from New York and Durban, South Africa, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
I think this conference is going to emerge for the first time with a declaration and a program of action which will, for the next 10 years, guide the international community on how to deal with the issue of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and other related intolerances.
The UN World Conference Against Racism in Durban draws to a close as delegates try to salvage a workable agreement in the face of opposition from the U.S. and Europe over the occupied territories and slavery. We'll talk to a leading member of the African National Congress and an Afro-Colombian woman speaking out on the racial dimensions of Colombian government's war against its own people. Today, the voices of women. Welcome to Democracy Now! In Exile. I'm Amy Goodman. Reversing the government's strategy in the landmark antitrust case against Microsoft, the Bush administration announced yesterday it will no longer seek a breakup of the company. The government also abandoned a central claim of the lawsuit that Microsoft had violated federal antitrust law by integrating its Internet Explorer browser software into its Windows operating system. The action was a sharp departure by the Bush administration from the Clinton administration's belief that breaking Microsoft apart is the only effective way to curb its business practices. As the first major antitrust decision by a new group of political appointees at the Justice Department, the move also suggests the Bush administration is willing to seek less severe penalties to move such corporate cases more quickly through the legal system. The decision is a stunning reversal for the Justice Department and the 18 states that remain in the case. State prosecutors and Clinton administration officials had repeatedly emphasized that Microsoft's antitrust violations demonstrated that a consent decree restricting the company's policies would never work to constrain the company from future violations. Microsoft and its employees donated $4.66 million last year to federal political candidates or parties, more than two-thirds of it to Republicans. This according to an analysis by the Center for Responsive Politics. And the company paid at least $6 million more to lobbyists who were charged with persuading politicians to accept Microsoft's point of view. Bush administration officials want to ease regulatory requirements on nursing homes, reducing the frequency of inspections and lessening or eliminating some penalties. This, according to government documents, as part of a nursing home quality initiative to be unveiled in the next few weeks by President Bush. In measuring nursing home quality, the government would rely in part on data reported by the industry, which has lobbied for relief from regulations it considers onerous. The New York Times reports the consumer groups, members of Congress, and unions that represent nursing home workers expressed concern about the initiative after hearing about it this week. "This sounds like the nursing home industry's deregulation dream come true," said the Service Employees International Union. The federal government regulates 17,000 nursing homes that care for 1.6 million people who are elderly or disabled. The homes must comply with standards in return for the federal money they receive through Medicaid and Medicare, about $39 billion a year. The White House yesterday rejected a demand to turn over documents sought by Congress in an inquiry into how the Bush administration's energy policy was formed. The GAO had demanded the White House respond by Thursday or face a lawsuit. Vice President Cheney has provided some information to the GAO, but not meeting records of President Bush's energy task force, which was headed by the vice president. The task force has been criticized for its closed-door meetings and meetings with industry officials as it developed the energy policy Bush unveiled on May 17th, which called for stimulating production of coal, oil, and nuclear power. Congressional sources say that while a GAO lawsuit was a possible next step, it was up to the GAO, which is the investigative arm of Congress. The GAO had no immediate reaction. UN Muslim leaders today condemned a federal search at the Texas offices of a Middle East internet service provider, calling it part of an anti-Muslim witch hunt. Anti-terrorism agents from the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation were part of the joint operation Wednesday that descended on the offices of Infocom Corporation, a Texas-based internet service provider that hosts a web portal servicing the Middle East. The search disrupted satellite television service in the United Arab Emirates, according to reports from Dubai. American Muslims view yesterday's action as just one of a long list of attempts by the pro-Israel lobby to intimidate and silence all those who wish to see Palestinian Muslims and Christians free themselves of brutal apartheid-like occupation. This was the statement of a coalition of nearly a dozen Muslim groups. Among the groups voicing their discontent were the American Muslim Council, American Muslims for Jerusalem, and the Council on American-Islamic Relations. One of Infocom's clients is the Qatar-based Al Jazeera satellite television network, the coalition said, a popular Arabic news outlet frequently criticized by Israel for its reporting on the situation in the occupied territories. Sudan's Catholic bishops accuse foreign oil companies today of complicity in brutal human rights abuses committed by the Khartoum government during the country's civil war. In a statement released at the end of their week-long annual plenary meeting in Kenya, the bishops said the war had intensified in the last 3 years, thanks in part to the government's profits from oil exports. The bishops accused the government of displacing civilians en masse in the south of the country to make way for oil exploration, a charge which has also been made by international human rights groups and some aid agencies. And in Washington, D.C., George Washington University officials announced they're shutting down and will force more than 5,000 students to leave campus for 5 days surrounding the IMF World Bank protest scheduled for the end of this month. The decision is one of the most dramatic steps taken so far for the protests, which are expected to draw up to 100,000 people. Tanya Margolin joins us on the line right now. She is a senior at George Washington University and an organizer with the George Washington University Action Coalition. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Tanya, can you tell us your reaction to the closure of your university?
We are here at George Washington all outraged, and we demand that the university reverses its decision and from now on starts including us in these dramatic decisions that impact thousands of students.
Did you know about this decision before it was announced yesterday?
No, absolutely not.
What are students going to do?
The students are organizing. In fact, this is bringing in students who would otherwise not be involved with the protests. It is bringing students who are apolitical but who just realize that this is not what democracy should look like on a college campus. This is our university, and we should be part of the university's decisions. The university went completely behind our backs and came up with this policy, and we received it over email yesterday with the university giving us no alternatives, no options. So we're organizing around this issue, and we're having a press conference, we're having speak-outs, and we're just having actions, and we're telling university we're not going to stand silent.
Now, much of GWU campus will be cordoned off behind a 9-foot-tall fence that city police are planning to erect around a swath of downtown D.C. to cut the protesters off from the World Bank IMF area. Is the university behind that cordon?
The university is partially behind that fence. In fact, most of the university will be on the one side, and the biggest freshman dorm is potentially on another side. But really, the talks of the fence are not clear to us because there are also talks of a bulletproof window door. So the university also keeps us in the dark about these issues as well.
And where are you all supposed to go?
Home. We are supposed to go elsewhere. They don't care, just as long as we're not here, as long as we don't participate in the protests.
Do you see this as the university taking a position on the IMF World Bank protests?
Absolutely. We never had illusions that the university was neutral, but this is just yet another loud and clear sign that the university sides with the IMF and the World Bank and that they're not neutral. Previous signs included the university giving an honorary degree to James Wolfenson, who is the president of the World Bank Group, and just in general, the attitude the university has taken towards protesters.
And does GWU, George Washington University, own the land under the World Bank?
We actually have been trying to figure this out for a few years now, but we know for sure that the George Washington University owns some land of the World Bank IMF. We're not sure how much. This is yet another sign the university doesn't want to publicly disclose how much exactly they own of the IMF World Bank. But definitely there is a close relationship between them.
You're off campus. Will this affect you?
this will affect me in the way that I will now have to house people who go to my own school, as opposed to providing housing for people who are out of town coming in for this protest.
Well, Tanya Margolin, I want to thank you for being with us. I know you're holding a news conference today with other students at George Washington University. Tanya Margolin, a member of the GW Action Coalition, helping to organize the World Bank IMF protests at the end of this month. And now to South Africa with Miriam Makeba Luta Continua.
And to those who have given their lives, praises to thee, husbands and wives, all thy children shall reap what you've sown. This continent is a home.
You're listening to Democracy Now in Exile, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go live to Durban, South Africa, the UN World Conference Against Racism entered its final day today, deadlocked over two issues: an apology and reparations for slavery and centuries of colonialism and the Middle East. Negotiations ran late into the night, but delegates were unable to reach an agreement on the issue of reparations and apology despite the mediation of Brazil and Kenya. African nations and NGOs from around the world want an unambiguous apology, the recognition that slavery and colonialism constitute crimes against humanity, and reparations. Sources close to the talks told the Agence France-Presse that Europeans are worried about the implications of an apology for possible lawsuits and are offering expressions of regret, sorrow, deep remorse, or abhorrence. Yesterday, Namibia's Herero people said they had brought a $2 billion suit in a U.S. court against three firms for alleged German colonial atrocities a century ago. Marathon negotiations have also failed to minimize differences between the European and Arab groups, which have persisted since the U.S. and Israel walked out of the conference on Monday over, quote, offensive language on the Middle East. Since then, South Africa, which is chairing the conference in Durban, has produced two new draft texts to address the issue, the latest presented earlier today as a take-it-or-leave-it option. Disputed wording in original conference documents produced during preparatory meetings had referred to ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, described Israel as an apartheid state engaged in a crime against humanity, and referred to the racist practices of Zionism. The latest text, produced by South Africa's foreign minister, expresses concern for the plight of the Palestinian people under foreign occupation, but avoids any explicit condemnation of Israel. Arab sources said the Arab caucus of the conference had rejected the text in its current form and want it amended. We're joined right now in the studios in Durban, South Africa, by Mavivi Meakiaka Manzini, head of international affairs for the African National Congress and an independent expert for the Committee to End Discrimination Against Women. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Well, it is the last day of the conference. Do you think it will end up producing any kind of agreements?
Definitely. I think the conference will come up with an agreement as negotiations between the various parties are continuing. As you know, that the two major things ranges on issues affecting the past, that is issues of colonialism and slavery, and also the Palestinian issue. And the two working groups, one headed by Ambassador Aboa, that is the one dealing with the past, and the second one headed by the Foreign Minister for South Africa dealing with Palestine, are sitting to try and find an amicable solution. The Africa group is also meeting in order to see how they can unlock the deadlock which is existing. Like in every UN conference, we do end up with a document, and we hope even at this conference we will end up with a document, and it will be a consensus document which we all would have agreed on.
What about the issue of reparations and an apology, how intimately linked they are? What do you make of the European countries, let alone the United States, pulling out in not wanting to apologize for slavery?
Actually, I think the issue of an apology, it is the minimum which is requested by the African states, by the people who have suffered colonialism, racial discrimination, and other related intolerances. Because if you look at what the people have suffered, it's tremendous. It's economic discrimination, it's social discrimination, which they will never recover. It will take years for them to recover. The victims are asking for a mere apology, and I don't think that's much. The apartheid regime in this country did that, and that's why we're able to achieve an amicable settlement to the problem of apartheid in this country. And we are not at the present moment, as it is being said, requesting for monetary reparations, but we are asking for a better place as developing countries, as former colonized countries, as former countries who have suffered through racial discrimination perpetrated by the same people who today wouldn't like to apologize. And that's what we're asking for. And I don't think that's too much for this conference.
What do you think of the U.S. pulling out? While ostensibly the United States pulled out because of wording over the Middle East, criticism of Israel for its treatment of Palestinians, a lot of people behind the scenes are saying that it was really because they didn't want anything to do with language around the issue of an apology for slavery.
No, I don't think they pulled out because of that. I think they pulled out because they couldn't get their way through, which is to dictate to the other states in this conference. If you remember, they were not there in the two conferences. And the conferences have continued to adopt resolutions, and the world has gone ahead to deal with the issue of apartheid. And as we're talking, we've been able to deal with the issue of apartheid without their participation in the past two conferences.
You mean the past two conferences on race?
On racism, yes, or the International Conference on Racism called by the UN. And even on this conference, I think we've been able to move even faster without them. And as Jesse Jackson says, they never even pulled in. They've been outside this conference. They just come to show face, and we never even saw their faces, nor heard even their voice, up until we heard that they've pulled out.
What about the role of the South African government as the central mediator in the most contentious issues of the conference? Can you describe the government's efforts and also what your role has been?
I think the South African government has played a very important role as the host, because it is the South African government which made sure that this conference goes ahead. It is the South African government which made sure that everybody is comfortable and is given a platform to say whatever they want to have from this conference and the outcome they would like to have. And it's based on the belief that we have to listen to each other and agree to disagree ultimately if we don't agree on points. But let us be able to listen to each other and to have each one of us give their point of view, never mind how small the state is, but each one of us at the United Nations are having an equal voice to raise issues of racism, especially that the racism we're talking about, racial discrimination, was suffered by countries of the South who at the present moment have no big voice as the bigger states of Europe and North America. And thus this conference was about victims of racism, racial discrimination, xenophobia, and other related intolerances. They were not about those people who actually introduced racism and thrived actually from racism.
We're talking to Mavivi Miyakiyaka Manzini, head of the International Affairs for the African National Congress. She is a liaison to the NGO community at the UN World Conference Against Racism. The Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU, and the South African Communist Party are your allies in what's known as a tripartite governing alliance. But they have criticized the ANC for its slow pace of land reform, for privatizing state assets, and in general for bowing to a Western agenda. In fact, there was a major strike last week with thousands marching in the streets. What is your response?
I think COSATU, as the trade union movement, has the right in this country to do that. If they feel that the pace of change is slow, they have the right to express it. But the government has got also other responsibilities. As you know, that this government is a government which is trying to balance many other issues in this country. It's not only to say that we're interested in privatization. We're also, the government base is to improve the lives of the people of this country, to create a better life for all the people of South Africa. And that agenda is still on. We won't be derailed from it. It might take long because of the various problems we are faced with. And one of them, is, if I may tell you, is not only linked to South Africa, but it's also the international atmosphere in which under which we operate, where we cannot move as fast as we can. The trade and economic relations in the world don't allow us to move as fast as we can and to come up with policies which will radically change the lives of our people in the shortest period as possible. And thus, the Millennium Africa Project, which we have adopted, which has now been adopted by the OAU as the new Africa Initiative, is all about changing those relations to make sure that even nation states are able to determine their economy and be able to access the markets of the world and be able to build their economies in the way they would like to have, without being dictated upon, without issues of structural adjustment, without being burdened with the debt, which most countries are indebted to the IMF, the World Bank, and many other international organizations. So what we are doing, it's to try and address the present conditions we're faced with as a country.
Do you support the World Bank IMF protests that are going to be taking place at the end of September in Washington, D.C.?
We definitely support such protests, because if they are going to make sure that relations between the South and the North are restructured, that countries of the South are going to get a better deal, that this will bring a better life to all the people of the world, then it is a good cause to support.
We're talking to Mavivi Miyakiyaka Manzini, head of international affairs for the African National Congress. We'll be back in a minute here in Durban, South Africa at the UN World Conference Against Racism.